You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off 2 or more select major appliances. Plus, get 3 Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
AITA for kicking my wife out after she abandoned our newborn? My wife, Jessica, convinced me she wanted to have a baby, and for some reason, I believed her. The day we got married, she dragged me to the hotel room, where she'd set up the whole thing with rose petals and balloons. I guess love really is blind, because 3 weeks later, we saw those 2 pink lines appear. At first, Jessica was thrilled. We spent every weekend looking at baby stuff on Amazon and had names picked out for both a girl and a boy from a parenting magazine. There was just one problem. Jessica didn't have many female friends. The 2 she had still lived in her hometown 3 states away, and all the women at her marketing firm were either jealous or resentful of her. After reading some articles about how important a support network of other women is for a mother, I knew I had to do something, so I arranged for her to attend a local women's empowerment group made up of women her age that met at the community center. I thought they'd be normal, progressive people. If only I'd known, as I dropped my wife off at the center, that it would be the last time I'd see her, because the woman who returned was no longer my wife. For the most part, normally, when I see my wife, she hangs on my neck and I spin her around. But this time I saw something I'd never seen before, hatred. Although she smiled immediately after and I thought I'd imagined it, she told me the meeting went very well, and I was practically overflowing with happiness. Little did I know that was the calm before the storm. She kept going every Tuesday and Thursday. Sometimes, it was even the best part of her week, and after 3 months, she came home excited, telling me how thrilled she was for the birth of our baby girl. I gently reminded her we didn't know if it would be a boy or a girl yet. That's when her face became extremely serious. I don't need an ultrasound to know what I already know. My body would never bring another man into this world. I swear I thought she was pulling my leg, but then she grimaced as if it were the most disgusting thing in the world. Jessica, come on. Boy or girl, it's our baby. That's all that matters, right? She turned away and started scrolling through her phone. I tapped her shoulder to get her attention again. Don't you dare, she hissed. You wouldn't understand. You're one of them. Her words hit me like a slap in the face, so I did what any husband would do in this situation. I called her sister, Brenda. You see, up until that point, my wife had been perfect. I hoped it was just pregnancy hormones, but I needed a safety net in case things went south, and since I was an orphaned foster kid who'd aged out of the system, that net had to be her family. According to Brenda, Jessica had always been very easily influenced by bad company. It usually passed, but she promised me that if our child was a boy and something happened, they would be there to help us immediately. I breathed a sigh of relief. Fast forward to the 20-week ultrasound. It was a disaster. When the technician cheerfully announced, "It's a boy," Jessica pushed the wand away and sat up. "Check it again," she demanded. "You're wrong." The poor technician looked bewildered. "Ma'am, I've been doing this for 15 years. Look here, clearly. I said check it again." Jessica interrupted. I had to physically restrain Jessica when she lunged at the woman. The technician called security, and we were escorted out. The day our baby was born should have been the happiest of our lives. But even before the baby was out, The nurses confirmed he was a boy. I jumped for joy. My wife started screaming louder, as if the pain of the news was worse than the pain of childbirth. And when Daniel first met me and his mom, Jessica just lay in bed, completely expressionless, holding him at arm's length as if he were an embarrassment. As soon as we got home, I knew it was time to break the news to my wife. Hey, your parents offered to watch the baby for a while. Yes, yes, 1,000 times yes, she exclaimed without hesitation. I told her they'd arrive in an hour, and she and Daniel went to nap together, the last nap with mommy. I was watching TV when I heard Daniel crying. My heart sank, and I ran upstairs, calling for my wife. But when I got to the top, the door was locked. A voice inside told me something was wrong. Desperate, I tried banging on the door to wake her, and when that didn't work, I used all my strength to break it down. What I saw broke my heart. My wife was lying right on top of Daniel. He already had bruises all over his tiny body. My wife insisted it was an accident, but I didn't care. As soon as her family arrived, I handed Daniel to them and asked them to take him to their house immediately. You almost killed Daniel, I yelled, my voice shaking. Oh, typical male chauvinist, always blaming the woman for things she can't even control. I stopped listening after that because, upon reviewing the baby monitor footage, I saw it all. My wife locked the door and proceeded to lie on top of Daniel, her eyes wide open. She had planned it. The first week began with me packing Daniel's things while Jessica watched from the doorway. She didn't help, just stood there, arms crossed. I grabbed diapers, formula, clothes, everything a baby needs. My hands trembled as I zipped the bag. Jessica's parents, Mr. and Mrs. Peterson, arrived minutes later, and her mother immediately took Daniel from my arms. He was still crying, those horrible bruises already forming on his little body. Jessica's father looked between us, his face pale. They left without saying much, just promised to keep him safe. That same night, I moved into the guest room. I couldn't bear to be near Jessica after what she'd done. The next morning, I drove to Home Depot and bought new locks for every door in the house. I installed them myself while Jessica was at her Tuesday group meeting. I also backed up the baby monitor recordings onto an external hard drive and hid it in my car. Something told me I'd need them. Jessica returned from her meeting angrier than usual. She went straight to the baby's room and started throwing his things into boxes. I watched from the hallway as she tore down the animal decals we'd put up together. When she noticed me, she turned. This room needs to be purified of his presence, she said simply. I walked away. By Thursday, she had cleared out almost all of Daniel's things. I came home from my job as a software developer to find her loading boxes into her SUV. Where are you taking those? I asked. She ignored me and drove off. Later that night, I noticed the SD card from the baby monitor was gone. My stomach clenched. I searched everywhere, but it had vanished. Friday morning, I found a note on the kitchen counter, Jessica's handwriting, precise and neat. The custody situation will be rectified sooner than you think. No child should be separated from his mother. My hands shook as I read it. I immediately called Jessica's parents to warn them. They assured me Daniel was fine, eating better, and her mom mentioned they'd set up a schedule where someone was always watching the baby. The second week started when I went out to my car for work and discovered all four tires were slashed, completely flat, the rubber shredded. A handwritten flyer was tucked under the windshield wiper. It accused me of misogyny, child endangerment, and using the patriarchy against a vulnerable new mother. The language was identical to the online posts from Jessica's group. I'd seen similar phrases on their social media when I looked them up after Jessica started attending. I called the police to file a report. The officer who came was sympathetic, but said without proof it was Jessica, they couldn't do much. I had to get my car towed and spent the rest of the day dealing with insurance. I missed work, which my boss was not happy about. When I finally got home that night, Jessica was in the kitchen, making herself dinner as if nothing had happened. Bad day? She asked without looking up from her salad. I didn't answer, just went to the guest room and locked the door. I could hear her humming in the kitchen. It was a tune I didn't recognize. It made my skin crawl. For the rest of the week, more flyers appeared, on my car at work, stuffed in our mailbox, even taped to our front door, all with the same accusations and the same language from her group. I started taking pictures of each one, building my own file. Jessica never mentioned them, but I'd catch her smirking when she thought I wasn't looking. The third week brought legal documents. A process server knocked on our door early Monday morning. Jessica had filed for sole custody of Daniel, claiming I was an unfit parent who had abducted him from his mother. The papers were filled with lies. She said I was abusive, controlling, and had isolated her from her support systems. Every accusation was the opposite of reality. I spent the next 3 days searching for a lawyer. I finally found one specializing in Fathers' rights. We met on Wednesday, and I showed him everything. The monitor footage, the backup, the photos of the flyers, the documentation of the slash tires. He reviewed it all carefully. "This is good," he said. "But we need more. Medical records, witness statements, anything that shows you're protecting your son." On Thursday, I drove to the hospital and got copies of the medical reports from the day Daniel was born. The nurses had documented Jessica's refusal to hold him properly, her comments about not wanting a boy. I also visited Daniel's pediatrician, Dr. Chun, who wrote a letter stating Daniel was thriving under his grandparents' care, gaining weight, and meeting all his milestones. Thankfully, the bruises had healed, but the doctor had photographed them during the baby's first visit. Friday was the emergency hearing. The judge, an older woman with gray hair named Judge Albright, reviewed both petitions. Jessica sat across the room with her lawyer, wearing a conservative dress I'd never seen before. She'd even put on makeup to look more sympathetic. When the judge asked about the imminent danger Jessica claimed Daniel was in, her
"You have 5 new messages.
Hey Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?"
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Lawyer stood. My client believes her child is in immediate need of his mother's care. The father has shown a pattern of controlling behavior, alienating the child from her. My lawyer calmly presented our evidence. Hospital records, the pediatrician's letter, photos of the damage to my car. The judge scheduled a full hearing for the following month, but denied Jessica's request for immediate custody. Jessica stormed out of the courtroom, her heels clicking angrily on the marble floor. The fourth week started quietly. I settled into a routine. Work, visit Daniel at his grandparents. They lived about 30 minutes away, return to sleep in the guest room. Jessica and I barely spoke, but on Thursday night, my phone rang at 2 a.m. It was Jessica's father, frantic. "The smoke alarms are going off. Something's burning in the kitchen." I threw on some clothes and rushed over. By the time I arrived, they'd put out the fire, a dish towel on a smoldering stove burner. The fire investigator who came said it looked intentional. The burner had been recently turned on, and the towel deliberately placed. There were no fingerprints on anything. When I got home at 4 a.m., Jessica was in bed, fully dressed. "Where were you?" I asked. She yawned. "Couldn't sleep. Went for a drive to clear my head. But I checked later, and the hood of her car was cold." The fifth week, the text messages started. Unknown number, burner phone. Dozens of messages calling me abusive, saying I'd stolen Daniel, threatening to expose my crimes to everyone. The language was familiar, same phrases from the flyers and Jessica's group posts. I didn't respond, just screenshotted everything. On Saturday, I drove to every convenience store within a 10-mile radius, checking security footage. I finally found it. Jessica buying a burner phone with cash 3 days before the texts began. The store owner at a Circle K let me record the surveillance footage on my phone, adding it to my growing evidence folder. In the sixth week, Jessica tried a new tactic. She convinced her younger cousin, Courtney, who was studying psychology at the local community college, to write a statement. Courtney sent it directly to the judge, claiming Jessica had suffered a postpartum psychotic episode the night she hurt Daniel, but was now fully recovered after intense self-reflection. I only found out because Courtney posted on Facebook about helping her cousin with her case, attaching the letter, I screenshotted it immediately. She deleted it an hour later, but I already had the proof. When I confronted Jessica about it, she shrugged. Courtney's studying psychology. She knows what she's talking about. I pointed out Courtney was only a sophomore, not a licensed professional. Jessica just smiled. The judge won't care about that detail. The seventh week, things escalated. Jessica's women's group started a GoFundMe campaign for her legal fees, claiming it would cost $10,000. The page described Jessica as a victim of domestic violence, a mother separated from her child by a controlling husband. Donations poured in, hundreds, then thousands of dollars. The breaking point came when Jessica posted a picture of herself on Instagram with a bruised arm, implying I'd hit her. I recognized the bruise immediately. She'd gotten it 5 days earlier by insisting on moving heavy boxes herself, refusing my help. I had the urgent care receipt from when she got it checked, worried about a possible sprain. The timestamp showed it happened while I was at work, with witnesses. I sent everything to GoFundMe with a formal complaint. They froze her account within 24 hours, pending a fraud investigation. Jessica was furious. She smashed plates in the kitchen, screaming about injustice. I locked myself in the guest room and called my lawyer. He told me to document everything, stay calm, don't engage. So I did. The eighth week was the hearing. Jessica arrived with her sister-in-law, Megan, who ran a local maternal support group. Megan clearly believed she was supporting an aggrieved mother. She sat behind Jessica, nodding as her lawyer painted me as a monster. During a recess, I approached Megan in the hallway and handed her a USB drive, wordlessly. She looked confused but took it. 20 minutes later, Megan returned to the courtroom, her face pale. She whispered something urgent to the bailiff, who spoke to the judge. After a brief conference, Megan was called as a witness. She testified she'd just watched the baby monitor footage of Jessica deliberately harming Daniel. More importantly, Jessica had called her the next day, begging her to support a lie about postpartum psychosis. Megan had refused then, but Jessica told her she'd find another way. The judge ordered an independent child safety evaluation immediately. Jessica's lawyer objected, but the judge overruled him. The evaluation was scheduled for the following week. In the ninth week, the evaluator from Child Protective Services, CPS, made a surprise visit to Jessica's apartment. She'd moved out of our house by then, renting a small place nearby. The report was devastating. Jessica had turned the room intended for Daniel into what she called a protest art installation. The walls were covered in slogans like "End Male Tyranny" and "No More Male Children." Pictures of baby boys in magazines had red paint splattered on them. The evaluator noted serious concerns about Jessica's mindset and her ability to safely parent a child. In the 10th week, Jessica made her most desperate move. On a Sunday afternoon, she showed up at her parents' house during their weekly family lunch. She acted sweet, remorseful, saying she just wanted to hold Daniel, that she'd been going to therapy and was getting better. Her parents, wanting to believe their daughter was improving, let their guard down. Jessica held Daniel, fed him his bottle, changed his diaper. Everything seemed normal until her father noticed her slipping something into the baby's diaper bag, adult strength allergy medication, ground into a powder. Her father grabbed Jessica's wrist and called for his wife. Jessica broke free and ran to her car. In her panic, she hit a parked car on her way out, leaving paint marks and a piece of her broken taillight. Neighbors saw the whole thing and called the police, but Jessica was gone by the time they arrived. In the 11th week, criminal charges came through. The police got a warrant for child endangerment via improper medication and hit and run. Jessica's lawyer, seeing the mountain of evidence against her, convinced her to take a plea deal. The agreement included mandatory therapy and supervised visitation only if a psychiatrist cleared her after 6 months. A protection order was issued for both Daniel and me. In the 12th week, Jessica's women's group imploded. Their treasurer discovered Jessica had been siphoning money from the GoFundMe campaign, even before it was frozen, using it for personal expenses like new clothes and spa days. Members started questioning other stories Jessica had told them. The group's Facebook page filled with apologies to me and Daniel. The online harassment stopped that same night. Several members contacted me privately, sharing disturbing things Jessica had said during meetings about her son. In the 13th week, we had the final family court hearing. Judge Albright reviewed everything. The monitor footage, the attempted arson, the medication incident, the psychological evaluation. She granted me full legal and physical custody, praising the protective steps I'd taken. Jessica could petition for limited contact after demonstrating sustained stability through therapy. The judge's words were firm. The child's safety must always be the priority. In the 14th week, I finally moved back into the master bedroom, packing Jessica's last belongings, repainting Daniel's room in soft yellows and greens. Jessica's parents helped me bring Daniel's crib back, installing safety gates on every staircase. We settled into a routine, weekly dinners where Daniel could be surrounded by loving family. Jessica's sister Brenda started coming too, bringing her own kids. Even Megan came once, apologizing for not seeing the truth sooner. Jessica began her court-ordered therapy. At 20 months, we had a progress review. Her therapist reported she was attending all sessions and was beginning to accept responsibility. She'd written an apology letter, which my lawyer forwarded. I read it aloud to Daniel during his bedtime routine, his big eyes watching me seriously. Then I filed it away. Maybe someday, when he's older, he'll want to read it. The court allowed brief, supervised visits at a neutral center. Jessica attended the first one. She held Daniel awkwardly for 20 minutes while a social worker observed, then left. 6 months after it all began, Daniel took his first steps. We were at his grandparents' for Sunday dinner. I knelt on one side of the living room, Jessica's parents on the other, all of us calling to him. He looked at us all, grinned, and toddled right into my arms. We all cheered. Jessica's mom cried happy tears. That night, after Daniel was asleep, I went to my car and deleted the last backup of the baby monitor footage. Justice had been served. My son's future didn't need to live under that shadow. We were free to move forward, surrounded by family who had chosen love over ideology, safety over anger. Daniel would grow up knowing he was wanted, protected, and cherished. That was all that mattered now. All right. The next Tuesday, I received a call from Jessica's therapist. She wanted to meet with me privately to discuss Jessica's progress. I agreed, thinking it might help Daniel in the long run, but when I arrived at her office, something felt off. The therapist, Dr. Richardson, seemed nervous. She kept glancing at her phone. "Your wife has been making some concerning statements during our sessions," she began carefully. "She's still insisting Daniel was stolen from her. She's fixated on getting him back, no matter what." My blood ran cold. "What kind of statements?" I asked. Dr. Richardson pulled out her notes. She's been researching custody laws in other states. She mentioned having supporters who would help her. I'm worried she's planning something. I thanked her and left immediately. That same afternoon, I installed security cameras around my house and changed all the locks again. I also called Jessica's parents to warn them. Her mother answered, her voice trembling. "We were actually about to call you. Jessica showed up this morning asking strange questions about our routine with Daniel. What time he naps, when we take him to the park, things like that." The next few days passed in tense silence. I constantly checked the security footage, looking for any sign of Jessica. Nothing happened until Friday afternoon. I was at work when my phone buzzed with a motion alert from the cameras. Jessica was at my front door, trying different keys in the lock. When none worked, she walked around to the back of the house, testing the windows. I called the police as I raced home. By the time they arrived, Jessica was gone, but she'd left something behind, a brown envelope taped to the back door. Inside were printouts from parenting forums where she'd posted under fake names, asking for advice on how to get a child back from an abusive father. The responses were disturbing. People suggesting she document everything, build a case, even consider moving to another state with different custody laws. That weekend was Daniel's first birthday. We'd planned a small party at his grandparents' house, just family and a few close friends. Jessica, obviously, wasn't invited, but somehow she found out. The morning of the party, balloons and a giant teddy bear appeared on their porch with a note. "To my baby boy, Mommy loves you." Jessica's father wanted to throw it all away, but I stopped him. "Keep everything. Document every single thing." We took pictures, saved the note. During the party, I couldn't shake the feeling we were being watched, and sure enough, checking the street, I saw Jessica's car parked three houses down. She was inside, watching with binoculars. I calmly walked over, tapped on her window. She rolled it down, smiling as if nothing was wrong. "Just wanted to see my son on his birthday," she said sweetly. "Is that a crime?" I reminded her she was violating the restraining order and needed to leave. Her smile vanished. You can't keep me from him forever. A mother's love always finds a way. She drove off, but her words haunted me that night. I barely slept. Monday brought a new complication. Jessica had hired a different lawyer, someone known for aggressive tactics in custody cases. He filed a motion claiming Jessica's mental health had dramatically improved and requesting unsupervised visits. The documentation included letters from three different therapists, none of them Dr. Richardson, but others Jessica had apparently been seeing without the court's knowledge. My lawyer was concerned. "She's doctor shopping," he explained, "visiting different therapists until she finds one who'll write what she wants. It's manipulative, but technically legal. We spent the week gathering counter evidence. Dr. Richardson wrote a detailed report about Jessica's continued troubling behavior. The security footage of her trying to break into my house was particularly damning, but Jessica's new lawyer was smart. He argued a mother trying to see her child showed natural maternal instinct, not criminal intent. The hearing was set for the following month. Meanwhile, Jessica escalated her campaign. She started a blog titled A Mother's Broken Heart, chronicling her journey to be reunited with her stolen son. The posts were carefully crafted, painting her as a victim of postpartum depression who was being unfairly punished. She never mentioned trying to harm Daniel, just that she'd struggled with mental health issues that were now resolved. The blog gained traction. Comments poured in from other mothers expressing sympathy, some sharing their own custody battles. Jessica responded to each one, building a support network. She was careful with her words, never outright lying, but twisting the truth until it was unrecognizable. Then came the interview request. A local lifestyle magazine wanted to feature Jessica's inspirational story of recovery. My lawyer advised against intervening. It would make me look controlling. So I watched, helpless, as Jessica posed for photos in a borrowed nursery, holding someone else's baby, talking about how much she missed her son. The article came out 2 weeks later. Jessica had given them a picture of Daniel, one taken in his first week, before everything fell apart. The headline read, "Local Mom Fights to Reunite with Son After Mental Health Crisis." The article portrayed me as an unyielding husband who abandoned his wife in her time of need. My phone blew up with messages, some from people I knew, asking if I'd seen the piece, others from strangers, calling me heartless. Someone leaked my work email, and the harassment found me there too. My boss called me in, concerned about the company's reputation. I wanted to defend myself, tell my side, but my lawyer cautioned, "Patience. Let her dig her own grave," he said. "The truth will come out at the hearing." But Jessica wasn't waiting for the hearing. She started appearing in places she knew I'd be. The grocery store, the gas station, the park where I sometimes took Daniel. Always staying just outside the restraining order's 100-yard distance. Always watching, taking pictures with her phone. One afternoon, as I was buckling Daniel into his car seat after visiting his grandparents, I noticed Jessica across the street. She was talking to an elderly neighbor, showing her something on her phone. The woman kept looking over at me, her expression growing more troubled. I later found out Jessica had shown her edited photos that made it look like I was handling Daniel roughly. The psychological warfare was exhausting. I started varying my routines, taking different routes to work, shopping at different stores, but Jessica always seemed to find me. It was like she had nothing else to do but track my movements. Then came the break-in at my office. Nothing was stolen, but someone had gone through my desk, papers scattered. The cameras showed a woman in a hoodie and sunglasses. Though her face was never visible, I knew it was Jessica from the way she moved, the set of her shoulders, but knowing and proving were different things. A week later, I found out why she'd broken in. A colleague mentioned seeing a disturbing social media post about me. Someone had shared photos of my workspace, highlighting a bottle of anxiety medication I'd been prescribed after everything with Jessica. The post claimed I was unstable and on drugs, questioning if I should have custody of a child. My lawyer filed a complaint, but the damage was done. The post was shared hundreds of times before it was taken down. Jessica denied any involvement, of course. Her lawyer claimed it was probably a supporter acting independently. The custody hearing was now 3 weeks away. Jessica's campaign intensified. She organized a Mothers Supporting Mothers rally in the town square, ostensibly about general custody rights, but clearly centered on her case. About 50 women attended, holding signs about maternal bonds and fathers weaponizing the system. I watched from my car, Daniel safely at his grandparents'. Jessica was at the center, tears streaming down her face as she told her version of events, how she'd suffered postpartum depression, how instead of help, I'd taken her baby and thrown her out. The crowd murmured sympathetically. Someone started a chant, "Bring Daniel home." That's when I noticed something chilling. Jessica was wearing a necklace with Daniel's picture, but not just any picture. It was one taken at his birthday party, the one she'd watched from her car. She'd managed to get that image somehow, despite the distance. The realization she'd been closer than I thought made my skin crawl. The rally made the local news. The reporter interviewed Jessica, who spoke eloquently about mental health stigma and mothers' rights. She mentioned the upcoming hearing, hoping the judge would see past the lies and reunite a mother with her child. The bias was obvious. The reporter clearly sympathized with her. That night, my phone rang at 3 a.m. heavy breathing. Then Jessica's voice, cooing like a sinister lullaby. Daniel's room looks so peaceful at night. Blue walls, elephant mobile, sweet dreams, my baby. I shot out of bed, ran to check the windows. Everything was locked, cameras showed nothing, but she described Daniel's room at his grandparents' perfectly. Had she been peering through the window? I called Jessica's parents immediately. Her father found footprints in the flower bed outside Daniel's window. The flowers were crushed. We filed another police report, but Jessica had an alibi. She'd been at an all-night diner with two women from her support group. They swore she was there from midnight to 4 a.m. The timing was too perfect, too convenient, but their stories matched. My lawyer was getting frustrated. "She's building a narrative," he explained. "She's making you look paranoid, unstable. Every time you report something, she has witnesses saying she was elsewhere. She's trying to make you look like the obsessed one." He was right. I was starting to question myself. Was I being paranoid? But then I'd remember that night with Daniel, the bruises, her cold eyes as she hurt him. No, I wasn't imagining it. Jessica was dangerous, and she was getting smarter. 2 weeks before the hearing, Jessica made her boldest move yet. She showed up at Daniel's daycare. Yes, I'd finally enrolled him. I needed to work full-time. She didn't try to take him, just stood outside the fence during recess, watching him. The teachers called me immediately. By the time I arrived, Jessica was gone, but she'd left something behind. Tied to the fence were dozens of pink and blue ribbons, each with a message. "Daniel, Mommy loves you. Families belong together. Let me come home." Other parents were reading them, some looking sympathetic. The daycare director was apologetic but firm. Jessica technically hadn't done anything wrong. She stayed on public property. That same afternoon, I saw Jessica's car parked outside my house again. This time she wasn't alone. Three women from her support group were with her. They didn't do anything, just sat there, watching my house. When I approached, they rolled up their windows and slowly drove away. The intimidation tactics were working. I was exhausted, constantly looking over my shoulder. Daniel sensed my stress. He'd become very clingy, crying when I left the room. Jessica's parents noticed too. Her mother had started anxiety medication. Her father installed a new security system. Then came the letters, not to me, but to everyone I knew, my boss, my colleagues, my neighbors, even the pediatrician, all written by concerned citizens, questioning my fitness to raise Daniel. The letters mixed just enough truth with lies to seem credible. They mentioned my anxiety medication, the multiple police reports I'd filed, making me look unstable, and asked why I was keeping a mother from her child. My boss called me in again. Though supportive, he was also worried about the disruption at work. Two colleagues had complained about feeling unsafe with all the drama. He suggested I take a few days off until things calmed down. I knew what that meant. Jessica was succeeding in isolating me. The pediatrician was more direct. "I know what's really going on," Dr. Chun said during Daniel's checkup, "but I have to warn you. Other parents are asking questions. They're worried about having their kids in the waiting room with you. It's not fair." I wanted to scream. Jessica is systematically destroying my life, and she's doing it by staying just within the bounds of the law, every move calculated, every alibi prepared. A week before the hearing, things reached a breaking point. I came home from grocery shopping to find my front door slightly ajar. My heart hammered as I dialed 911 and cautiously entered. The house had been searched, not violently, but thoroughly. Drawers open, papers disturbed, pictures moved, but nothing was missing except one thing. Daniel's favorite stuffed elephant, the one he slept with every night. Police found no signs of forced entry. The security cameras had mysteriously stopped recording an hour before I left the house. The system had been hacked. That night, Jessica posted a picture on her blog, holding Daniel's elephant, tears in her eyes. The caption read, "Found this at a Goodwill donation center, my baby's favorite toy, discarded like he never mattered." This is what happens when fathers get custody. They erase the mother completely. The post went viral within her support network. Comments flooded the page about heartless fathers, about maternal intuition, about the obvious signs Daniel needed his mother. Someone started a petition on change.org demanding the judge review the case. It garnered 1,000 signatures in 2 days. My lawyer was blunt. She's playing the long game, and she's playing it well. But we have the evidence, the original footage, the medical records, the witnesses. Don't let her get in your head. But she already had. I wasn't sleeping. I'd lost 15 pounds. My hands trembled constantly. The stress was affecting my work, my relationships, everything. Just as Jessica wanted. She needed to make me look unstable, unfit, incapable. 3 days before the hearing, I made a decision. I took Daniel and went to an old college buddy's house in another city, about a 4-hour drive away. I needed to get away from Jessica's constant presence to clear my head and prepare for court. My lawyer supported the move. It showed I was prioritizing Daniel's well-being. But Jessica found us in less than 24 hours. I don't know how. Maybe she'd planted a tracker on my car. Someone in her network spotted us. But there she was, at the local park where I'd taken Daniel to play. She didn't approach, just sat on a bench, feeding ducks and watching us. I immediately packed up, but the damage was done. She'd proven I couldn't hide from her, that no matter where we went, she would always find us. The message was clear. There's no escaping a mother's love, or in her case, obsession. The night before court, I couldn't eat. Daniel sensed my anxiety and refused to sleep. I paced his room, holding him, wondering if I had enough fight left in me. Jessica had turned what should have been a clear-cut child protection case into a dirty battle of narratives. My phone buzzed with a text from an unknown number. "Tomorrow, everything changes. Sweet dreams." I didn't sleep at all. At dawn, I dressed Daniel in his best outfit, packed his go bag, and steeled myself for what felt like the battle of my life. Jessica had spent months building her case in the court of public opinion. Now it was time to see if the actual court would see through her manipulation. I dropped Daniel off at his grandparents. His grandmother hugged me tight. "You're doing the right thing," she whispered. "We know who Jessica really is. The judge will too." I hoped she was right, because if Jessica won any kind of unsupervised access to Daniel, I knew in my gut we'd never see him again. She'd flee, disappear into her network of supporters, and spend the rest of her life poisoning Daniel against me. The courthouse loomed before me. Through the glass doors, I could see Jessica already there, surrounded by her supporters. She wore a conservative blue dress, hair pulled back, looking every bit the grieving mother she pretended to be. Her eyes met mine in the lobby. She smiled, that same cold smile I saw the night she hurt Daniel. I walked into the courtroom, the weight of the world on my shoulders. Jessica's supporters filled one side, murmuring amongst themselves. My side had only my lawyer and a few family members. The contrast was stark. The judge entered, and we all rose. It was a different judge this time, Judge Martinez, known for her thoroughness and fairness. Jessica's new lawyer was on his feet immediately, launching into a passionate speech about mother's rights and the importance of second chances. He presented the letters from Jessica's new therapists, highlighting her remarkable recovery. My lawyer countered with Dr. Richardson's recent report, laid out the pattern of escalation, the break-ins, the harassment, the stolen elephant. But Jessica's lawyer was prepared. He produced affidavits from the women at the diner, security footage showing Jessica there during the 3 a.m. call. He even had a tech expert who claimed the blog post about Daniel's elephant was written from a public library computer, not Jessica's device. The judge called a recess. In the hallway, I watched Jessica, surrounded by her supporters, playing the victim role perfectly. One woman was even crying as she patted Jessica's shoulder. My lawyer pulled me aside. "This isn't going well," he admitted. "She's raised reasonable doubt about everything." When we returned, the judge had questions. She grilled me about the anxiety medication, about why I'd taken Daniel out of town. Jessica's lawyer pounced on every answer, twisting my words. I felt like I was drowning. Then Jessica took the stand. She was brilliant, tears at just the right moments, voice cracking when she spoke about how much she missed Daniel. She acknowledged using poor judgment in trying to see him, but framed it as a mother's desperation. She even apologized for the elephant incident, claiming she found it at a thrift store and got emotional. The judge seemed moved. She asked Jessica about the art installation in the nursery. Jessica had her answer ready. It was her way of processing trauma, recommended by her art therapist. She claimed she'd since painted over it and had a proper nursery ready for when Daniel could visit. My heart sank. Jessica was winning. The judge announced she would review everything and issue her decision within a week. As we left, Jessica brushed past me. "See you soon," she whispered. The week was torture. I barely left Daniel's side. At his grandparents', we installed more cameras, changed the locks again. Jessica's parents were as worried as I was. Her mother confessed Jessica had been asking about Daniel's passport and if they kept it at the house. Thursday afternoon, my lawyer called. His voice was grim. The judge is granting Jessica supervised visits, 2 hours every Saturday at a court-appointed center, starting this weekend. I felt the floor drop out from under me. But the evidence. It wasn't enough, he cut in. The judge believes Jessica deserves a chance to rebuild the relationship under supervision. I'm sorry. I hung up and just sat there, numb. Jessica had won. Not completely, but enough. And I knew this was just the beginning. Saturday came too quickly. I dressed Daniel in his favorite dinosaur shirt and drove to the visitation center, my stomach in knots. The facility was cold, cameras everywhere, a social worker waiting. Jessica was already there, wearing a soft pink dress, her hair in gentle waves. She looked like a mother from a parenting magazine. The social worker took Daniel from my arms. He immediately started crying, reaching for me. "It's okay, buddy, I managed. Daddy will be right here." I had to wait in another room, watching through a one-way window. Jessica tried to engage Daniel, offering him toys, singing songs, but he wanted nothing to do with her. He kept looking around, calling for me. 20 minutes in, Daniel was inconsolable. The social worker had to end the visit early. Jessica's face as she left was terrifying, not sad or disappointed, but furious. For the first time in months, she'd lost control of the narrative. The next few visits were similar. Daniel cried. Jessica grew frustrated. The social worker intervened. Jessica started complaining that I'd poisoned him against her. She filed a motion claiming I was coaching him to reject her. Meanwhile, the harassment ramped up again. My car tires were slashed twice more. Anonymous calls to my work increased. Someone reported me to Child Protective Services for neglect. They had to investigate, though they found nothing. 3 weeks into the visits, Jessica made her move. During the visit, she suddenly clutched her stomach, claiming severe pain. The social worker called 911. In the chaos, Jessica grabbed Daniel and made a run for the exit. Security stopped her at the door, Daniel screaming in her arms. The police were called. Jessica was arrested for attempted kidnapping. This time, there was no denying it. It was all on camera, her supporters couldn't spin it. Word spread through her network, and many began to question her story. At her arraignment, Jessica's lawyer argued temporary insanity brought on by separation from her child, but the judge wasn't buying it anymore. Bail was set high at $250,000, and Jessica's parents refused to pay it. Finally, it seemed, enough was enough. While Jessica was in jail awaiting trial, I discovered the extent of her plans. Police searched her apartment and found detailed notes on Daniel's routines, maps with highlighted routes, even a fake ID with her picture, but a different name. She'd been planning to flee. Her women's group officially disbanded. Former members came forward with disturbing stories about Jessica's behavior during meetings. One revealed Jessica tried to recruit her to make false reports about me. Another said Jessica bragged about manipulating therapists. The criminal trial was swift. The security footage, witness testimony, and evidence from her apartment painted a clear picture. Jessica was convicted of attempted kidnapping and criminal harassment. She received a 2-year prison sentence with mandatory psychiatric treatment. During sentencing, Jessica finally dropped her mask completely. She screamed across the courtroom, promising me she'd get Daniel back, that I'd pay for stealing her son. The judge ordered her removed. With Jessica in prison, life slowly stabilized. Daniel stopped having nightmares, became less clingy, more willing to play on his own. We kept our routines, visits to his grandparents, playdates with cousins, a normal little boy's life. Jessica's parents struggled with guilt. They'd enabled her behavior for so long, making excuses. Her mother started her own therapy, trying to understand how she'd missed the signs. They remained devoted grandparents to Daniel, determined to be the stable family he needed. 6 months into Jessica's incarceration, I received a letter from her, not directly, that would violate the restraining order. It came via her lawyer. She wanted to relinquish her parental rights in exchange for me dropping the civil suit for damages. Her lawyer explained she'd been diagnosed with several personality disorders. The prison psychiatrist believed she would never be safe around Daniel. I agreed immediately. The papers were filed, and within weeks, Jessica was no longer legally Daniel's mother. It was final, irrevocable. Daniel was safe. The day the papers were signed, I took Daniel to the park. He ran around, laughing, chasing pigeons, just a happy little boy. A woman nearby remarked how adorable he was. She asked about his mother. I just said I was a single dad. It was easier than explaining. That night, after Daniel was asleep, I sat in his room, watching him breathe. The elephant mobile Jessica described in that sinister call was long gone, replaced by spaceships. The walls now covered with his preschool artwork. This was his room, his safe space. I thought about the journey, the fear, the exhaustion, the constant vigilance, but also the family support, the strength I'd found, the love that kept me fighting. Daniel would grow up without his biological mother, but he wouldn't lack for love. Jessica's parents were already talking about how to explain things when he was older. We'd tell him the truth, that his mother was sick and couldn't safely care for him. We'd answer his questions honestly, but age appropriately. We'd make sure he knew it wasn't his fault. For now, he was just a happy kid, learning new words, discovering the world, surrounded by people who would protect him. The battle was over. We'd won. Not in the way anyone would choose, but sometimes protecting the innocent means making hard choices. I closed Daniel's door quietly and went to my own room. For the first time in over a year, I slept through the night. No checking locks, no reviewing camera footage, no startling at strange noises, just peaceful sleep. In the morning, Daniel woke me by climbing into my bed, chattering about wanting pancakes. I scooped him up, carried him to the kitchen. As I mixed batter and he played with measuring cups, I realized this was our new normal, simple, safe, ordinary. The future stretched out before us, full of possibilities, school, sports, friends, all the normal childhood things Jessica had tried to steal from him. He would have challenges, questions about his mother, moments of confusion, but he would face them surrounded by love, supported by a family that had proven they would always be there for him, no matter what. I made a dinosaur-shaped pancake, Daniel's current obsession. He clapped and giggled. In that moment, in our sunny kitchen, flour everywhere and syrup sticky on the floor, we were just a father and son having breakfast. The shadows of the past year couldn't touch us here. We were home. We were safe. Yes, we were family. If you liked it, don't forget to leave a comment and support the channel by subscribing. See you in the upcoming stories.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.